Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Magical thinking and the limits of American military power. This is the state of the so-called negotiations to end the war in Iran, started by the United States and Israel. Iran is in no mood to compromise, nor should it. Crosstalking the war on Iran, I'm joined by my guest, Murel Karimi in Toronto. She is a lecturer at Toronto Metropolitan University, as well as author of The Iranian Green Movement of 2009. In Berlin, we have Kavork Almasyan. He is founder of Syriana Analysis. And in Tehran, we cross to Helia Dotaji. She is a scholar of international law and political economy based at the University of Tehran. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Kavork, let me start out with you in Berlin here. Donald Trump says that the ceasefire is on life support. I would posit, my friend, that there's never been any good faith negotiations coming out of the White House. I think they are undecided on what to do, how to move forward. They don't know how to get out of the mess that they've brought themselves in with, along with the Israelis, which probably plays a very important role in all of this. No negotiations are really going on. They simply don't know what to do, and they're probably weighing their bets on return to hostilities. Your thoughts?
I think if we have to evaluate what is going on in the United States nowadays, there is a brilliant article in The Atlantic. The title goes by Checkmate in Iran, and the author is Robert Kagan. And for those who don't know who Robert Kagan is, Robert Kagan is the husband of no other than Victoria Nuland. This man has made a career of advocating for military interventions and wars of aggression, especially in West Asia or in the Middle East, and also is a co-founder of a warmongering think tank. And he is arguing basically in this article that the U.S. has suffered a total defeat in Iran that has no precedent basically in the U.S. History, in the recent history. And this can neither be repaired or ignored by the American public or by the American administration. Therefore, when we see the initial strategy failing and then the doubling down on the same strategy, this indicates that there is a lack of competence among the planners in the U.S. administration of how to exit this conflict. Because at the current moment, in my opinion, there is no third way. The first way is the compromise with the Iranians, which means there has to be serious compromises from the American side, since the Iranians now enjoy more leverage compared to what they used to have before the war, or they would go for an escalation. Now, an escalation, in my opinion, in this case, is going to lead to serious global economic upheaval. This is no longer about only 20% of the global energy routes. We're talking about complete cutting the global economic system, basically, as we know it, because cutting the hydrocarbons, cutting the fuel, and then probably in Bab el-Mandeb, there could be another blockade by the Ansarullah. So what is going to happen to the global economies in this case? So are we going to witness what they call the Great Reset in this case? Because there are so many talks and conspiracy theories about this. I'm not adopting it. All I'm saying is that the escalation now in Iran is going to lead into global economic upheaval, one of which would lead into hunger and famine in certain regions in the world. So we have to be very careful about how the Americans would move and what would be their next move. I personally do not think that the Americans will de-escalate and go to the diplomatic path at the current moment.
I don't either. Murel, if I can go to you in Toronto, I mean, there is no evidence that they are negotiation capable. I compare it to the conflict going on in Ukraine. Whatever your thoughts on that conflict, the Russian side has presented its terms of engagement. The West and the Europeans particularly don't engage that. Iran is doing exactly the same thing. We all know what Iran wants, okay? But Donald Trump calls it garbage, but we don't know what he wants other than unconditional surrender. Go ahead.
Well, that unconditional surrender, essentially capitulation, is what Trump wants, and that is precisely what he's not going to get. I mean, we always talk about political analyses, and as a social scientist, let me give you an example of an observation, multiple observations that I've made over the years of how American exceptionalism actually works, because I was always interested in understanding the minds of American people and their politicians, and how do you justify so many wars of aggression, so many coups, so many, how do you justify that? And so over the past few months and over essentially a year now, I'm listening to many largely American men speak on a variety of platforms, and they're so they have this deep conviction and deep-seated belief in their exceptionalism, and that they can go into any country that it is and just take what is not theirs. And so they cannot believe it. It's fascinating, really, as a social scientist, to just watch them. Well, they cannot believe.
You know, Morel, you know, it's really interesting. My father was a veteran of the Second World War, and I used to sit in the living room with him and watching the footage coming out of Vietnam, and I was horrified by it. And my father said, well, we're not doing anything bad to these people. We're trying to help them. That's the mindset that we still have to this day.
Essentially.
The American people, the Western world, doesn't realize that the United States and Israel started this war. Keep going.
And exactly. And what if, you know, just throwing it out there, what if the Iranian people don't want your help?
Yeah.
What if this is actually not help? This is really not help. I don't get me wrong, by no means am I absolving the Islamic Republic of its human rights violations, of the fact that it's an authoritarian state. I've written and talked about it in many different contexts. However, I think the principled stance is not one or the other. We have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. While Iranians have their own domestic issues, they're also dealing with these problems of sovereignty. You do not get to just walk in and attack and essentially be a bully. And now they're losing. You have to understand it. I mean, look, who am I talking to? Like, you're an American man. You understand this. Their psyche just cannot handle that this country from the global south that they've, you know, demonized for, 47 years now is standing up to them.
And winning. And winning. Okay? That's what's most important here. Let's go to our guest in Tehran. It's very interesting to me in looking at the so-called negotiations and so-called ceasefire is that the West, and particularly the United States in this case, does not see Iran as a legitimate interlocutor. They do not have legitimacy. And this is what the problem is here, is that the demands that Iran is presenting the United States, the region, and the world is doing it because it has the cards to do it. And that is something that the West cannot comprehend. We've just heard a country from the global south standing up to the West. That doesn't compute in their mind. Go ahead.
Right. I agree. And this is not a situation where negotiations are determining the dynamics on the ground. I don't believe so. I think the relative containment we're seeing is not the product of a diplomatic breakthrough or the ongoing negotiations, but of deterrence. The reason the United States, despite repeated, as you said, you know, violations of the ceasefire from day one, has not escalated into another large scale strike just yet is because Iran has been able to alter the cost benefit escalation through its capacity to impose meaningful costs on U.S. military bases in the region. And in parallel, there is also the domestic dimension, right? There is a renewed political consolidation and sense of mobilization within Iranian streets all across that reinforces the state ability to project power externally while asserting sovereignty. And from a strategic standpoint, any serious reading of negotiations must, in my opinion, look beyond the diplomatic table to the military balance underpinning it. Iranian military officials this week including senior commanders in air defense, have publicly emphasized that their missiles are locked and loaded, right? They're like remain fully prepared and alter. They're waiting pending the Supreme Leader order. In that sense, negotiations are not producing deterrence. Deterrence is shaped and is being shaped by the space within which negotiations are taking place. And this is in the context, unlike before, allow Iran to set preconditions and conditions for the United States at the table. Yet, you know, you don't see a defeated enemy. You don't take preconditions from your defeated enemy. That sets a strategic defeat for the United States, unlike what we've seen before.
Well, that's exactly, Kvorak, let me go back to you. I mean, we just heard a marvelous summation there, is that we've got into the habit in the West of making a deal. No, Iran doesn't want a deal. It wants recognition of the strategic shift in the region and quite possibly in the world. That's what it wants, and it has the cards to do it.
Well, Peter, speaking about the arrogance of the American officials during the negotiations, it comes partly due to, in my opinion, of the inferiority complex in the region that many people believe that they cannot advance and they cannot develop unless they would receive the Western or American or European support, in this case, whether intellectually or economically or technologically. Well, let me remind your respected audience, this is a region which holds its grip over the Strait of Hormuz, it holds its grip over the Bab el-Mandeb, it has the Sinai, it has the Strait of Gibraltar. This is a very, very rich region with a great economic choke points, but they don't use this leverage, let's say, vis-a-vis the outside world, because the after First and Second World War, most of the governments in the region are puppet governments.
Exactly.
In exception for now Iran, which is showing to the world that it is possible to become independent and advance and develop. And therefore, this is not only a geopolitical conflict, but rather also a conflict of a narrative. If Iran emerges victorious from this, survives, and proves that it can advance, develop, and preserve its own sovereignty, then what is the use of all these American forces in the region, and why would all these countries depend on American protection and technology and industries? What happens if Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Syria and Iraq and Iran come together and integrate their economies?
That's
they will
what,
become a
that, that,
very
they,
strong, relevant region.
That's what exactly they want to avoid, because you can only have peace in the region if all of the players in the region come together with many, many differences, maybe, but they're the ones that have to determine the fate of this region and the defeat, the strategic defeat of the United States in this conflict. Only, I think, it makes it almost inevitable. All right, I'm going to jump in here, and we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the war on Iran. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the war on Iran. Okay, let's go back to our guest in Toronto. Morel, what is, you know, we all know that Benjamin Netanyahu was interviewed on the American programs. CBS, it's important considering its ownership these days of the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. Again, we see what is the role of Israel in the decision making on the Israeli-American side, because again, I got the impression from the interview that Netanyahu is very much involved in Trump's decision making. Now, given the mess that their advice gave the world, this unprovoked war, it doesn't bode well with future decision making. Would you not agree? Go ahead.
Well, you have to understand, the United States is the grand hegemon in the world. Certainly, they want to continue to be the grand hegemon in the Middle East, yet they are a declining empire, and Israel is their instrument in the region. And while they definitely have their own domestic interests and, you know, political strategies, they, and Iran has, and it, I firmly believe it has very little to do with the rhetoric of the Islamic Republic, though I must say, in terms of diplomacy, Islamic Republic's rhetoric against Israel has not been helpful to Iran or their cause. However, even previous Iranian regime, the Pahlavis, they were also turning against Israel because the interests certainly don't, you know, they clash, they don't match. And you have to understand the issue that United States has with the Islamic Republic is not that it's not a democracy. It's not that it's an authoritarian state. It's not that it violates human rights or opens fires on protesters. It is the fact that it is defying its hegemony. And that has been the case for 47 years. And we have to understand that. And Israel continues to feed the United States. And sadly, the United States, and they're so hungry and they're so unaccepting of the fact that this one nation can stand up to them, that they buy this faulty intelligence, and they actually buy. I do not understand who provides the political and sociopolitical analyses for these people, but they actually, maybe they just wanted to believe that the Reza Pahlavi would be capable of ushering in a new regime, or that he would be accepted, or that he would have
he would be nothing more than a puppet, obviously. I mean, where has he been living for his entire adult life? Who's been paying him? I mean, let me go to our guest in Tehran here. I have been told by Iranians on my program and other places that there is a revolutionary fervor going on, and you've already touched upon it here. It may not be the backing of the Islamic Republic, but certainly Iran's sovereignty. This is what's bringing people together, and particularly young people, which is very interesting because we've always been told in Western media that young people are in revolt against the Islamic Republic. What's going on the ground now?
I think what reveals itself in the streets of Iran is not the binary that the Western propaganda wants to project. It's not, protesters versus the supporters of the state, the economic grievances versus those who are nationalist or supportive, patriotic. It's much more complex. The overwhelming majority of those who gather in the streets night after night for now, 70 days, they constitute working classes of Iran. Those are the original actors of the revolution, of the 79 revolution, whose bodies and whose households bear the most immediate cost and weight of the violence, of the imperial violence of the war. And this sector is most vulnerable by the campaign of this crisis, the crushing sanction over the decades, the neoliberal reforms within the country, which have now led to, a high inflation that really impact their food purchasing power we're witnessing. But indeed, this class is often fearlessly and with full justification, I must add, critical of the government's economic conduct. Yet, and this is the point that escapes the Western commentators, is that they have not ceded the streets to the binary. Instead, they have transformed the streets into a single, unified, and indeed revolutionary site of two simultaneous acts. One is the defense of the national project of independence against external enemy and against the U.S. imperialism. That is the protection of the territorial and political integrity of the only state in West Asia that stands against genocide. And second, it is that they made it the demand that this same state advance and realize the original promise of the 79 revolution, an anti-imperialist foreign policy, because people on the streets are demanding no compromise with the United States through an agreement. And second, domestic political economy oriented towards social justice, redistributive welfare, and the material dignity of the working class. So the working class in the streets, to answer your question, is really showing us is not waiting for permission to choose between resistance against U.S. imperialism or demand for change or advancing causes internally, because it has already chosen both.
It's so fascinating because it's so rare in the West to hear something. And I don't think anyone in the West has ever heard anything like what you've just told us in my audience here. Kvoda, I don't see there's a negotiated end to all of this. And I say that not knowing what the end is, okay? But I don't see any kind of deal being made. The American Congress is not going to ratify a treaty with Iran, okay? The United States, once it puts sanctions on a country, almost never takes them down. Where is this going to go? I mean, obviously, what they call kinetic action is always on the table. I don't have a crystal ball for this. I don't know anyone that does. Go ahead.
Well, I don't want to get myself into trouble, Peter. However, Netanyahu yesterday was on 60 Minutes, and he said it's not over in Iran because there is still nuclear material. And when he was asked how does he envision the highly enriched uranium to be moved from Iran, he said, well, you go in and take it out. President Trump has said to me, I want to go in there, which means there is a plan of trying again to hijack the enriched uranium of Iran, which is a very complicated operation. It seems that at the current moment, the planners...
But that wouldn't change the strategic balance right now. The Strait of Hormuz, for example, the destruction of American military bases in the Gulf that will never be repaired and never used again. Okay, you can take the uranium. Is that the trophy that Trump shows everybody so he can walk away?
That's why it increasingly looks like this is becoming a stalemate at the current moment in the region, with Americans not having much options against the Iranians in this case. And this is turning, of course, some of the countries against the Americans. And in this case, yesterday or on Monday, the foreign minister of Iran has spoken with MBS or the officials in Saudi Arabia. And I think when the Saudis told the Iranians as well that they cannot use their territories in this freedom operation, whatever it is called by the Americans, it's quite clear that the mood in the region is shifting. Let's say, in exception of the UAE, most of the countries see that the American forces have become liability in their countries. It impacts their economy. Saudi Arabia has a 2030 economic vision. They want to host the World Cup. And this is all not going to happen if this stalemate continues in the next few months. Therefore, the main reason, in my opinion, and I said I don't want to get myself into trouble, it's Israel. Israel is the reason for the continuation of this conflict at the current moment, and Israel is the reason for this stalemate, because the main reason for this animosity between the United States and Iran is Israel's imperialist aspirations in the region, and they would like to become the dominant player, and they would like to use the American forces to establish what they call the Pax Judaica Empire in the region, which extends from the Nile to the Euphrates, and beyond that, controlling the Strait of Hormuz. If they bring the Pahlavi to power in Iran, they would control the Strait of Hormuz, they would have enormous leverage over the region, and all the countries in the region would be subjugated for the Israelis. This is an imperialist project by the Israelis themselves. Of course, they cannot do it without the Americans. However, they have invested and they have hijacked the elite in the United States. They have bribed the Americans. They have compromised the American officials in order to make this war possible. Therefore, I always say, if the Iranians want to end this, the end is in Netanyahu. Netanyahu has to be removed from power in order for this conflict to come to an end. Otherwise, we will see continuation of the stalemate.
On that minor point at the end, I disagree. It's not about Netanyahu. It's about Zionism. That's the problem.
I said
here.
I don't want to get myself into trouble.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to get in trouble. I don't. I live in a place where nobody polices my speech, believe it or not. Let's go back to Toronto. And you know, one of the things that, you know, overall in looking at this conflict here, one thing I think we can all agree is there's no return to the status quo ante. Everything has changed. And it doesn't mean I know what's going to happen. I know we're not going to go back to the past. Last 30 seconds go to you. Go ahead.
Just a quick note about Kevork. I agree, and I've been saying it since day one, that Israeli and U.S. interests will diverge. But the positive news, I think, here is that Netanyahu or whoever replaces him and wants to continue this war won't be able to do it without American backing. So as soon as, you know, the U.S. pulls out their support, they won't be able to continue. However, Iran will be, because they are not backed by others. What I'm worried about right now is the domestic conditions in Iran. The fact that these sanctions and the pressures on the currency, and also, as Helia was talking about, domestic economic policies, the neoliberalization and the rentier state are
a topic for another program. Fascinating discussion. I truly enjoyed this. I want to thank my guests in Toronto, Berlin, and in Tehran. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.